Mr. Lowndes, Reel 30. In terms of casualties, and you've mentioned that the burial detail, when you had a casualty, would you always have to, a fatal casualty, would you always take the pay book and the identity disc?
No,
You wouldn't.
don't take. No. The burial party do that. No, if when the burial party, whether it was just so happened that I was on it,
Would that be, this would be, this would be
but
days
I'm
after the
just talking
burial.
about in general terms now. Whatever, whoever was on that burial party would automatically go, would go for the 2 means of identity, which was the disc, and the playbook.
What about if they were members of the platoon, friends within the platoon? Would you be careful? What about personal effects? Would you leave
Oh,
them?
no. Well, you mean to take them?
Well, to safeguard them from being taken by people other than people that.
I would say that that would be unlikely, I should think.
So you would just move on.
It'd be unlikely, I think. Unless there was something about it that you knew about that would make it a different, slightly different. But if it wasn't like that, then you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't do that.
Was there ever occasions when you thought that the bodies might have been booby-trapped by the enemy? Any
No,
time
not
in Italy?
really. No, well, I don't think really that thought. No, I don't think I would have. I personally wouldn't have thought that. I'm not saying it didn't happen, mind you, but because I may well be wrong, but I would have thought it was unlikely. I would think. I mean, I'm taking, if I was just taking that case of Vic Chadwell there, I mean, I didn't know if there was him. All I was told that there was a body, could have been anybody. But, I mean, when I could see who it was, I recognised his face, and all I needed was his number to make a proper report to the company commander, that's all. But I had no intention of taking that paper from his pocket for anything else, because I put it back again in his pocket and did his pocket up before I left him.
So that would be the job of the burial detail. Would they be members of the battalion?
No, the party, not the ones I just told you, that burial party I went with, that was the people that was in it, like I told you. And what I didn't say was that Sergeant Griffin would have been there, and he would have brought some of the stretcher bearers with him.
So that'll be it will be
So it'd be like the Padre, the medical officer, Sergeant Griffin, the stretcher bearers, and then the personnel from Pioneer Platoon, Carrier Platoon, anybody, any other company even, but not your own company, a different company.
And they would be in charge of.
They would be, they, you see, they wouldn't know those people there that were on that burial party. Most of them wouldn't have known George Pawley. I don't think they would have known him. I doubt it.
Oh.
They might have done, but they don't.
So was that a way of protecting the casualties' friends from having to go through that detail?
Well, yeah. Yeah, it was
So you
really.
wouldn't actually see the
Yeah.
people that you knew.
Yeah, it was. Yes, right. You see, take for instance George Pawley. Well, it just so happened that in D Company at that time, George Pawley had a lot of friends because they were all people from the 70th Young Soldiers, and Ken Oliver was one of them, and he was there, Jemima, and he was in another platoon. But you see, he wouldn't have liked to be on that burial party because he knew George Pawley. It's upsetting for him,
Just to continue to focus on Germano, could you describe the routine in the front line at this time, how the rations were brought up, for instance?
Oh, yeah, that was difficult there, because that would have been, it would have been the compost stuff or the clay. It was something, you know, that you could sort of, when you get them all together, you know what I mean, in a box, or it used to be in a box or something, in a cardboard thing. We used to have to go and fetch them. We used to have the tea, and it was all loose, wasn't it? And the biscuits and that sort of thing. I think they were compost or clay rations, weren't they, or something?
Clay rations were the American ones. Were on American rations as well, then?
We have had them. We did have them sometimes.
But how do they compare with the British?
Well, they were more tasty. They were more tasty because they had more variety in them.
What variety? What did they have?
Well, I mean, they went for things that they fed their troops differently than what we did. As bully beef and biscuits sort of thing, whereas they would try and spice it up a bit and make it a little bit more appetising.
So what would they have?
Well, they would probably throw in some of your cheese or something like that, a little bit of, you know, all done up in packets and that sort of thing. But that sort of thing, we never used to get, we never used to worry too much about it, as long as there were some rations of some sort. But the most important thing, of course, was the tea. And the other thing, the most important thing, was the means of boiling some water, making a cup of tea. Whereas the American rations used to give you a little burner, which you could light with a match. And if you're going to make some tea, you use a mess tin, and, you know.
How did you heat the water with the British rations then?
Well, I don't think we had, for a long while, we never had any. We never had anything with them. They did start to give us those little, I don't know what they're called, and they gave them a name, but you know, the little tiny ring on them and all, little tiny thing. You could put them in a box and set light to they were quite safe. I don't.
So what was the did you have any kind of favourite foods within the rations? Did you look forward to certain things being in the boxes?
Well,
or did you hope that certain things were in the boxes?
Well, the American ones were because you get some biscuit things, but they were whatever they were, whether it was they were sort of spiced up a bit, you know, they were more tasty. But that was their way. They used to do everything like that. And ours, you know, you used to get the chunks of cheese and that sort of thing. Whereas they used to do the little packets, and it was easy to, theirs was easy. It was easy to, if you were, had to distribute, you'd have to distribute, you know, to people, and it was easy to do it.
So theirs were kind of individual packets, individual soldiers.
Yeah.
And the British, they had to be, divided in it?
Divided
after you'd opened the box.
That's it, yeah.
What about cigarettes? Were they important in the front line?
Well, we had, because you get the standard issue of, weekly thing, and you used to get that from the colour sergeant, and you'd have a tin of cigarettes and a bar of chocolate, and what used to happen there was that one day a week he would get them and put them, they would come with the rations, so that everybody was always sure that he was going to get a tin of fag and a bar of chocolate. But, and then we used to have that, we used to have that plain Gornbor stuff. Wasn't very good. In time, we began to get better, and they got some better type, you know, better type and more palatable. But well, we all used to get cigarettes.
What about the quality of the cigarettes?
Well, they usually tinned, nearly always players. In those days, the players, most of the cigarettes never had a filter tip on them. The only time you got a filter tip on a cigarette was possibly in the nappy rations, where you wouldn't get the nappy rations while you were in the line. You'd probably possibly get nappy rations if you came out of the line for a little spell. And then you might get some, if you like that sort of thing, you crave an A or something like that, with a cork with a tip on, you know. But that's the only time otherwise it was always the straight, the tins of nearly always players.
Did you always feel that you had enough cigarettes when you were in the front line?
Yeah,
What about smoking in the front line?
You had to be careful about that, because there you see, for instance, that position, just to give you an example, that one, wherever we were there.
That's a Germano.
That Germano, even us there. I mean, during the daytime, you could, where we were, I'm only talking about my platoon now, there was no reason why anybody in the step tent shouldn't put a fag on and light a match, and nobody would be any more the wiser, because nobody would have seen that, not from the position where they were. But I'm only talking about the hours of daylight now. Of course, if that happened at night time, you would be in very serious trouble. Very serious trouble. Nobody even attempted that.
Nobody tried to smoke. Because other veterans have talked, there's like a way of with a tin and an overcoat and so on, a great coat.
Yeah, they probably gave it a thought, but I never knew of. Well, I did know of people who tried it, but you had to, if you did do it, it was on your own head if you did it, you know. I wouldn't personally have tried it.
Was that the fact that the cigarette would make you visible at a long, long distance?
Well, yeah, it's surprising what you can see. I mean, when you think that you can, it is possible to look over the ridge and see somebody firing, and every now and again you get around a tracer, which is the same effect, really. You see, and, you know, you just get that difference all of a sudden that something shows. And especially if it's dark, you won't see maybe so much in daylight, but you will in the dark. It's surprising how it gives you position away. Now I reckon that that is what, when that Corporal Goldstone went forward like he did, I reckon that he'd seen something down there. He'd seen something to make him go like that. Because, you know, there was no holding him back. All of a sudden he went. I would like to have said that I knew, I don't even know to this day whether he's still alive or not, I don't even know. But I do know that I read somewhere that he'd been listed as a POW. So I imagine from that, that whenever that was printed, he must have been alive. I should have said he survived the war, just put it that way.
Now,
there was no question that he was taken.
Now, in the front line at Germano, were you able to wash? Were you able to shave?
No.
Not at all?
No, we had nothing, no. No, or no. The only people I think who would have been able to have had any attempt at a wash of any sort, I think, would have been, I was going to say, those who were lucky enough, but if they were, you see, you've got to remember that They would probably have wanted to establish some sort of they would want to establish the regimental aid post for a start. I would think that they would look for somewhere in the village of Jamalo for that. They would also be looking for somewhere to establish some sort of battalion headquarters, maybe. They would need some sort of a room or something for that. But at the same time, the way Jamalo was, it was in a dreadful mess, and I should think they would have been pretty hard put to find somewhere that was even reasonably safe. Yeah, because they were the only people who would have been able to possibly get hold of some water and have a wash. And for the likes of us, I'm afraid we had no chance, you know.
So the water, did you have enough drinking water? Did you have?
Well, we only had the water bottles that we. And of course, there again, it was your responsibility to make sure that you always had some water in it.
And how would you fill them on Jamalo?
Well, what we used to do there was we used to have to get water where we could, really. That's about the only way to answer that.
From streams and so on?
Well, yeah. But we used to, they used to try very hard to, they had a certain particular vehicle in transport. Most transport people, you know, in the battalion transport, like the water wagon, like the people who use for the oil, you know, that sort of vehicle. Well, every opportunity you had, if you knew that that was around, if it or anything like that, you would have to go and fill up, which was cool. You know, otherwise you would have to rely on maybe civilians or something, somebody that says the house with a tap or something. You know, you just have to do it for yourself.
Were you issued with kind of water purification tablets?
We did have that because they were a bit frightened, like as you said just now, about filling right from a stream or a river. But you see, that's a bit dangerous, and we used to get issued with those little pills, that same as we did, you know, for the anti-malaria things, same sort of thing, very similar type of thing. You just simply put it into the bottle, and that was it. But you could always get them. I mean, they were always available if you wanted them.
Now, you were on Jamalo, you'd moved forward, you'd taken this ground. What happened after that?
I think we were... we were relieved from there. The company commander, when he said to me about the time that he thought we would be there, he wasn't far wrong. He was a little bit longer than what he said. But I think somebody came and took our place. And he was kept in the same positions. The Germans had retreated quite a way. They had for their own sakes, they had to get on the other side of that riverbed for a start. And quite a long way beyond that. In the meantime, they probably got fresh people up, and they were using the flanks a bit more, and so as to, because we made quite, after Jamalo, we made quite a lot of ground. Not all down to us, but it was all, some of it was down to other people as well. But we did make quite a bit of ground after that, you know, we didn't know what it was going to be like there. I I mean, it's not a horrible place, I do. That was one of the few places that, in my time, and in the army, that I sometimes think about. I think I will always think about. Sometimes, the Juano was one of them. Salerno was another one, because that was something that I never expected to do. What we did at Salerno, and there are one or two things that you don't think about it at the time, but after they've happened, you do. And you think to yourself, well, thank you, that happens to me. That happens to me. But, it's just the way it is. You just don't know what's coming next, do you, really?
So what did come next?
Well, I think it was the old routine. We were back to looking at the long-term thing again. It was getting across the River Po. That seemed to be everybody's major headache.
The battalion history talks about the battalion crossed the Rubicon in September 1944, just after Germano.
I'm not sure whether.
And you mentioned off the tip that you were wounded at this.
I'm not so sure. I think that's where we were going. I think that's where we were going when I was wounded. I think that is where we were going. That's what I said to you at the time when you said that.
And you talked earlier on the tape. We moved forward earlier in the interview, and you described how you were wounded. Can you just briefly just mention that again?
We've got to this. It wasn't a bad layout. There was a fair amount of cover. We were going to move off in the morning, and it was pretty cold. I remember it was pretty cold that night, and I can't remember. So far as I remember, the company commander was still the same bloke, still Steel, so far as I remember. Anyway, it was pretty cold, and what they'd done, they sent a message back for a 1500-watt truck to bring up either some blankets or the greatcoats. I think it was the blankets. But they sent that back. So this 1500-watt truck came up, and we were, I'm now talking at company level, really, because although the remainder of the battalion we were quite closely bunched, but they were all going, when we moved off, they were all going their separate ways. And so far as we were concerned, we found ourselves, there was an old farmhouse, a big shed, and an old farmhouse, a brick building, there's an old farmhouse. Anyway, I sent for these blankets, and so the 1500-watt truck came up, and I don't know what happened really, but it seemed that as soon as the 1500-watt truck arrived, we started to get mortared. We were getting mortared, and it only seemed to happen after this truck arrived. I don't know what happened. I can't think that he'd been spotted, because he didn't have any headlights or anything like that. But what I mean is, he didn't make a noise, but they just started to mortar us. And we were getting these blankets off, and a lot of this was going over the head, and I was hoping and praying that we weren't going to get hit, because I'd gone into the farmhouse, or what it was. They had a roof on it, but I'd gone in there, and a lot of us had, and after a while, you know, we kept on, and all of a sudden there was something happened with the vehicle. This 1500 truck, all of a sudden, I think that the vehicle, something either hit part of that vehicle to set off something off. And it's almost like a car alarm, if you see what I mean. And it was constant all the time. And of course, being early in the morning, and it was quiet and dark, and of course, it sounded, you know, and that was that. We were getting fairly well watered, and I was hoping very much that. In fact, I thought first. What I thought to myself, I'll move out, go outside, and not be in the house. So anyway, it was too late because I was just thinking about it, and we got two on the roof. And direct hit on the roof of this farmhouse, and we were up. There was an upstairs and downstairs. There was a wide wooden staircase leading up from downstairs to the next floor. And we were on the upstairs floor, and of course we got the worst of them. Those two, there were quite a few casualties there because. I mean, that's where I got mine. I've heard it. It's the old story of all of a sudden you hear it and then you don't. And that's when you know it's close to you. And that's what I heard, you see. Anyway, I heard that bit, and I never knew no more. That was the last I heard. I didn't know anything after that. So I can't exactly tell you what the situation was like. All I know is it was a hell of a mess. And
so where did
somehow they got us out. They got us out of there, and everybody that was hit as well, me included. And the next time I came round, I was in a field ambulance just outside Rimini. I can't put it any closer than that because I was just outside Rimini, I remember.
And how had you been injured?
Oh, I'd this arm was broken.
That's your left arm.
I was back of my head was sort of split open, and I was all the way down here.
That's your right leg.
Down the right leg. And I never knew any more until I came round in this field ambulance place. And I was on a stretcher. I can remember I was on a stretcher. And then there were loads and loads of us there. And they were taking these stretchers out one by one. And then two boats come up and they came to me and they said, "Oh, because I had my arm like that." So somehow got my arm like that.
So your left arm, braced up.
And that was for that arm. That was only a straightforward break. Anyway, they lifted me out, left me out. So I said, "Where are we going then?" He said, "You're going on the aeroplane." He said, "You're going down Naples." I said, "What?" He said, "Naples, yeah." He said, "You're going down." He said, "You're going on the plane soon." So they took us down to Naples from there, to the 95th General Hospital in Naples. That's where we went. And we went down in the old RAF Dakota plane, and it was specially done with put all the stretchers in. I can remember being put on the plane, and then I passed out again when I was on the plane. And when I came out again, I was in the hospital ward in Naples.